Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 23rd, 2002. Today's session is titled, Communicating Across Cultures, Session 2, How Do Men and Women Differ in Their Communication? Presented by Jeff Kirsten Grip. The number is KGJ2002-07. Let's listen in.
Go ahead and start, Lisa. This is I don't know what number session this is, but it's part of a series on intercultural communication I've been doing here for the last week and a half or so. Tomorrow's the final session where we hopefully will have the punchline. We'll be applying what makes for a competent intercultural communication. We'll see if we can get you to think of men and women communicating as if it were communicating across cultures. And we'll apply some of the principles we know work when you go to, say, Nigeria, and see whether they work when you go to man. see what you think about the fit between those guidelines and attitudes and things and this particular situation. Tonight's session, though, is based on last night's discussion, which really talked a lot about the relationships among culture, gender, and communication. And we're going to pick up where we left off, talking tonight mostly about talking, about how men and women characteristically communicate with each other, and some of the built-in misunderstandings that you've experienced and some others that have been researched. I'm interested to share some and to hear some. For many of you, I think you will like what we have in store for you this evening. Let's see. I wanted to start by saying a little bit about this book. If you're interested, this is a book that talks about precisely what we're doing tonight. You just don't understand. It's about 10 years old now. How many of you have read this book? Okay, you should talk to these people if you're curious about this book. It's in the bookstore, I think.
It is.
Okay, good. There's still some left. But Deborah Tannen is a linguist who studies what she calls genderlects, the dialects that are characteristic of men and of women. And in that regard, her work, I think, is of higher quality than someone like John Gray, who's talking about, by virtue of being born with a penis, you are on Mars. And being born without one means you're on Venus. And I think it's less essential than that. This one talks, is kind of one step removed from that. It says that we are socialized to have a certain way of doing our sex, and that often comes out in some pretty predictable scripts. I hope you don't mind me teaching barefoot tonight. I don't want you to read anything into it except that my shoes were really sweaty. My name is Jeff Kirsten Grip. I'm a professor. I've been teaching college for 18 years. I'm currently at the University of Portland in Portland, which is a private school. It's a Holy Cross school, part of the Notre Dame network. I had $5 for every time I've heard the words Notre Dame since I've been there. And I'm a professor of communication studies, so I know more about communication than I do about gender, but this happens to be an area where the two interests coincide pretty easily. My goal tonight, just like last night, is to start the engine and get out of the way. So I want to give you some information to chew on and then solicit your opinions and experiences, and then we'll see what we can make sense of together, all right? Yes, this will be not one of those sitting and listening sessions. This will be a relatively interactive session. Everybody has an opinion about this issue. I encourage you to enjoy each other's opinions and to respect each other's opinions, and we will have our fun time. First of all, I want to review a couple things. When we're talking about gender, that's not the same as sex. Sex is your biology. Gender is how you learn to do your biology. Okay, I was born into this particular body. Okay, society has some pretty strong scripts about how I ought to act, given that I am, in fact, of this sex. So gender is really a social category, and it's expressed symbolically. That means in all of our interactions with each other, we're learning a lot about how we're supposed to be, how we're supposed to do, what kind of human doing should I be. As a man, okay, what should I be doing? So we learn how to do our sex. It's influenced, there are three influences that are often talked about. One is biology, and many people will say, oh, biology's destiny. You got testosterone in your body, you're gonna be aggressive. It's been proven. Yes, it has. And there have also been studies, I named one last night, where social class also made a difference. That high testosterone levels did increase aggression in everybody except men who are of a higher socioeconomic status. And we batted around some explanations for why that might be. The heart of our discussion there was that social life can really trump biology. If you are of a certain class, a certain standpoint, you may see yourself as not necessarily having to respond aggressively. So you don't necessarily do your gender just based on biology. There are some good cultural explanations for how we get to do our gender. And I would tie those to these communication explanations, which of course I favor as a communication studies person. But I pay attention to those kinds of explanations, partly because I know a lot about them, and partly because I find them really hopeful. That if gender really is something that we negotiate with each other, as individuals and as a society, doing it in our communication with each other, then really there's some hope for actually changing things around if we want to. We aren't bound by the messages that maybe we're encouraged to give. I want to say something about this and then come back and say something about these two words and then start to ask your opinion about things. First of all, here's a little model for that's been driving all of our thinking over the last couple weeks. It really privileges communication. It says, you know, you can't do a lot about your biology. Culture may seem a little bit remote, but in fact, by your everyday interactions with the other people in your life, you have an influence on that. So really, here's the assumption I'm starting from. One is that men's and women's communication reflects a culture, okay? Culture encourages me to behave a certain way, so I often do. It enacts cultural expectations. It helps to negotiate what those expectations should be. Think about yourself here at Holden Village. Have you been trying to change the culture in any way? Not regarding men and women, but have you been trying to bring out the parts of the culture that you really like through your interactions with other people? So we do that kind of stuff with each other. And it helps to recreate and continually negotiate these notions of gender and culture. So for many people, it's not controversial to think that, okay, you're part of a certain culture, and that culture says, okay, ye shall communicate in a certain way. That direction is pretty comfortable for people. My culture makes me communicate this way. What's a harder move for people to understand is the one that goes back the other way. It says, I communicate this way, and thus I'm really influencing the culture in which I live. That's hard to see on an interaction by interaction basis, but really that's the only way social change happens, is kind of a person at a time. And that it really is much more fragile than we give it credit for. We really are negotiating these pieces as we go along. So we see communication, in my field, we see communication as interacting with cultural values and practices, meaning it isn't just influenced by culture, but also influences culture. That it interacts with accepted gender meanings. What's okay to do as a man? What's okay to do as a woman? And these things have been in incredible flux for about the last 20 years. I can't do what my grandpa did. Okay, that's not okay anymore. And yet, I really can't lay out what it is I ought to do instead. But that's still kind of in flux, too. So we're negotiating those things. And there's some play between gender and culture, too, that the culture keeps trying to make up its mind about what we ought to be doing and being as men and women. The punchline of yesterday's session was really these prime directives for being masculine and being feminine. These are from research. Several of you had some others that pretty well fit the categories, but there may be some differences. If you're a man, the prime directive is to be masculine, right? And to be masculine primarily means that you're not feminine. That's the primary thing to do, to be masculine. Don't be feminine. Don't be feminine. Okay? That's a bad thing. If you want to be fully enfranchised in American culture, you want to run for office, make a lot of money, advance in your company, don't be feminine. Okay? These aren't traits that get you anywhere. One person was here as a woman talking about being in those kinds of circles and talking about the greeting rituals she felt obligated to do that were the, wasn't it, handshaking rituals? Doing handshaking rituals at Boeing in the masculine setting, that if you were running around the room arranging flowers, you wouldn't get to the same kind of, you wouldn't get the same rewards as you would by learning the masculine code for that particular situation. You're expected to be successful, to be envied rather than to be liked as a man. It's more important to be successful and to be more successful as a man. You're expected to be sexual. You're supposed to be recognizing the sexual implications of virtually everything and responding to it at some level, otherwise you're not really masculine. Aggression is an important piece of masculinity. Not manhood now, we're talking about masculinity, talking about a gender role. But that being aggressive, if somebody threatens you or someone you love, you are less manly if you don't respond in kind than if you do respond in kind. And you're supposed to be self-reliant. In American culture, this research is about 14 years old, so it's just shifting, but still a lot of this. There was a lot of nodding last night. Women are still expected to be attractive, to be sensitive and caring, to carry the burden of that, to expect negative treatment by virtue of being a woman occasionally, not constant negative treatment, but just by the fact that you're born a woman, you are more likely to be treated negatively just because of that reality than you would if you were born a man. You're more likely to walk into doors that were open for other people. And you're expected to be superwoman. Not just that you can, but that you should. What, you just stay home and take care of the kids? Oh, you work, but you have no children? Oh, that's interesting. You hear these messages from people? So the woman's role especially is very confused lately for many women. There isn't a straight prescription about what you're supposed to do. And on one hand, that gives you freedom to explore your own path. On the other hand, gives you very little guidance about what's okay. And maybe a lot more weight placed on each of the interactions you have with people when the accepted role isn't quite so clear. This last piece I want to say here is this notion of ascription and avowal. They're two $5 words. Hope you like them. Use them all over the village in every party situation just to show that you've been to this session. They can be like passwords. Ooh, nice avowal. I'd like to buy a vowel, please. Someone last week talked about kids from other cultures and why they, if you're adopted out of your home culture, why is it that they really feel a call to get to know that culture if there isn't some sort of biological imperative to identity? So, you know, let's pretend if you were adopted out of Brazil, why is it that you really want to go find out about Brazil? The easy explanation would be, well, there must be something biologically calling him back to Brazil. And Karen, I think you talked about, you have a couple you've adopted too, who are from another country, and that people keep often looking at them and saying, you know, you don't belong here. Clearly, you're a different color, you're from a different place. They keep ascribing an identity to those people based on how they appear. And the kids, of course, feel kind of obligated. Well, if I'm not this, well, then who am I? So you can see ascription and avowal as sort of a social explanation for that same phenomenon. Why wouldn't I want to find out about Cambodia if I'd been adopted from there? When people keep talking to me as if I'm not from here, well, of course, I must have to find out something about there then. So I just want to present that also as evidence that really a lot of the identity making that we do with each other really is an active process that we do all the time. We're doing it now. You remember that commercial for Palmolive? You're soaking in it, remember that? You're soaking in it. That's what you're doing in all your communication, is that you're negotiating something about your identity. And avowal is the identity you offer for yourself and hope that somebody else will affirm. For example, in my communication here, I'm offering messages that hopefully encourage you to see me as somebody worth listening to. You are ascribing identities to me with your response. There was sort of a respectful silence there, and then a laughter to break the tension, acknowledging my eyes going back and forth looking for something. Okay, we negotiated that pretty well. There'll probably be another one now. And we just keep doing this thing with each other, that I'm always ascribing certain identities to the people around me and avowing certain identities in how I present myself. Communication is very complicated. We're not just saying hi. We're also saying, hi, I think I have the right to say hi to you in this way. I construct you as this sort of person, what do you think of that? And your response might just sound like, hi. But really underneath all that is, well, I don't really like that view of your view of me. I'm going to change that view a little bit with how I change my tone and tell you what I think of that and what I think of you and what I think of our relationship. Hi. There's a lot going on, and I'm not telling you anything you don't know here. You know this, right? You negotiate this stuff all the time. You don't. We're not glib about our communication with each other. So all of these things really get tied up then in how we then learn to speak to one another and the kinds of things that we do with each other to enact this stuff. And really what we're up to tonight is to talk about the two separate speech communities we can talk about, the two, if you like, two separate codes or genderlects that we are socialized to honor as men and as women. Men, of course, are socialized in the direction of the masculine code. Women are socialized in the direction of the feminine code, generally. And most of this research has been done on Caucasian North American college sophomores, so keep that in mind. That's most of who gets studied anymore about this kind of stuff. But I do want to share some information with you so you can, first of all, see the two codes. Then I'm going to ask you to see if you can compare your own experiences against these codes. And I want to hear what you have to say about these things. Let's talk about feminine first. Feminine style, they hear a code of connection and intimacy. But that's what communication is for. Communication is for connecting with other people and getting to deeper levels of understanding with them. And recognize I'm not talking about all women. I'm not talking about all women all the time. These are central tendencies, which is all we can really study. You can think of exceptions in your head, and I would encourage you to do so. But feminine style really features communication as the essence of relationships. So first of all, communication's used to foster connections. That's why you communicate. You match experience to show that you had the same experience, you have some solidarity with that person, and you want to maintain equality with that person. Feminine style also shows support. You express understanding of the other person's feelings or their situation. I'll try not to lose any off the screen here. Third, women especially, people using a feminine style, are encouraged to attend to the relational messages that you hear beyond just the content of the message. Hi. Hi. Anybody feeling called to investigate that second hi? Are any of you women, perchance, who are subscribers to a feminine style? I'm a relatively feminine communicator, androgynous communicator, as a man. And so I very seldom let an opportunity like that go by. And we're going to ask you some stuff about the costs of doing that later. But that women tend to listen not only to the content of what's being said, but also to the relational implications. That's part of the role. That's part of the gender lect, is you pay attention to that code. Fourth, women tend to sustain conversations. They'd be invitational in their intent, that your goal is to include rather than exclude in conversation. Women also tend to be responsive, effusively so responsive. Grunting is just the bare minimum of feminine repertoire. In fact, a large part of conversational code in a feminine style has to do with being responsive to the other person and being open and inviting. Being personal and concrete, we use a lot of disclosing about ourselves. This is funny, I'm using we. Use self-disclosure, so you say some things about yourself and you'll share anecdotes about yourself if you're a subscriber to a feminine style. And last, women tend to have a tentative style. They leave the door open for other people. For example, there's research in communication that says women tend to end a lot more statements with what's called a tag question, don't they? It's a tag question, where it's a perfectly good sentence, but you put a comma there and you add a couple words to make it into a question. Why do that? Well, it's much more, it's much more invitational. It sustains conversations. If you're not having the last word, but you're inviting another word. The problem for users of a feminine style is that can be interpreted as uncertain or underconfident by people who don't understand the code. And it's not just that you're being invited in, you might be heard as taking a position of weakness. Okay? So here are some things. Women speak in their language of connection and intimacy, and here are some of the ways that shows up in this kind of stuff. Let me talk about the masculine style, and I want to ask your opinion about things here. Trying to save some time. That piece. Here we go. Now men, we are socialized to a masculine communication style, and that's got different goals, first of all. Okay? Different goals and also different ways to encode and express intimacy and support and understanding. That all those things are expressed differently in the male code than they are in the masculine code, than they are in the feminine code. So for example, what we're hearing is a code that is all about exerting control, enhancing status, and preserving independence. Especially in North America, man, we like our autonomy doing this. So one of the things we do with our communication is we use it to exhibit our knowledge, our skill, and our ability. This doesn't happen in your lives, does it? You ever have a conversation with someone where you get to work in something that you're really good at? Okay. Men tend to focus on using communication to get things done. Okay. We achieve the task, the content goals. You get together to talk with somebody because there's a problem to solve or something to work on. You want a nice linear meeting that gets you from point A to point B, makes everything fixed. Third, we tend to be in conversation with each other so that we can exhibit conversational control and dominance. The masculine style has this trait. It doesn't mean that everybody tries to dominate every conversation, but it's a tendency in the masculine style. Part of what's there. For example, if you like to be really funny in conversation, as I do, I have to. That's not to say I am funny in conversation. But that I have to pay attention to myself and think, why am I doing this? Am I doing it to railroad the conversation? Do I really want the best from the people around me, or am I just trying to hold the floor? What am I up to? Third, third men or fourth, men tend to use non-tentative expressions, just as the feminine style tends to welcome sort of a tentative, I think I know what's going on here. We are much more socialized to sound certain about what we're saying. Oh, no, it'll be fine. It'll be fine. Just relax. It'll be fine.
Don't worry.
I worked on that all afternoon. Okay, be more impersonal and abstract, whereas feminine style emphasizes being more concrete, telling stories on yourself, anecdotes, disclosing about yourself. Men might speak in more cliched language, you know, hang in there, buddy, you'll be all right, you know, that kind of stuff. Less concrete and personal than a feminine way of communicating. And men, we tend to share more minimal response cues when we're listening. That really sometimes going, is perfectly appropriate in a masculine code. And of course, that can be misread as disinterest by users of a feminine code. People just don't recognize that you were, in fact, just listening and responding to it. That's our call of acts. Did you hear it? So whereas women hear a language, speak and hear a language of connection and intimacy, men speak and hear a language of status and independence. That's really what we're up to. We're paying attention to these things in terms of how they place us in society. These codes really come early. And some of the most interesting research I've read has to do with the rules of kids' games growing up. Carol Gilligan, you may have read In a Different Voice at one time in your life. Studied girls' play, and several other researchers have studied boys' play just to see what sorts of communication rules get socialized into kids at this age. How do kids communicate, and what sorts of things are characteristic of their play? And I have to read these because I don't know them by heart. Girls' games cultivate three communication rules. For example, one, those games often use cooperative talk to create and keep relationships. So let's, Tori loves to play house, for example. And lately, oh, today they were playing Wilderness Survival up all around Chalet 12 and pretty much around the village. You may have seen them putting splints on each other down here on the nature trail. And I'm not sure what the splints were made of. I haven't asked Tori yet because we haven't made her clean up quite yet. But that part of that kind of play is cooperative talk, kind of designed to keep people in it, imaginative play. You're building these realities together. Second, girls tend to avoid criticizing, outdoing, or putting others down. Many of the women in the room sometimes hear this and go, huh? I don't remember that. So that's a place where you might disagree with Gilligan. And last, they tend to pay attention to other people's feelings and relationships, so that part of the game, part of girls' play, is to pay attention to those kinds of things. Boys, on the other hand, think of yourself playing baseball, for example. We use communication to assert ourselves and our ideas. That's the point of communicating when you're a boy. We use talk to accomplish something. We use talk communication to attract and keep an audience. And we use talk to keep the floor and rest the focus onto ourselves. So part of a game, part of the point of boys' games is to make yourself the center of attention, is to really take advantage of your moments in the spotlight. And you know, you do something great, make sure everybody sees it, you know, and make sure they remember it the next time you play. Those kinds of things there. So what I'm hoping I've shown you so far are just the bare bones of these two different gender lexes. Here's how men are often socialized to speak and hear things. Here's how women are often socialized to speak and hear things. I have some scenarios where people often misunderstand each other, but before I share those, I'd actually like to hear from you. And I want to do this in a different sort of way. I'd like you to get together just in a same-sex group of three or four. That means if you're a man, don't sit down with any women. I want you to sit down just with men. In fact, let's make this the men side of the room here. Since men are more self-reliant and more willing to travel, plus Karen has her foot in a cast over there, let's get the men over here. And just sit down in groups of three or four. What I want you to come up with are your most common missteps or misunderstandings or misperceptions with women. When do you feel most misunderstood? What are the times that you can predict where you're very likely not to be heard in the way you intend to be heard? Women, same question for you, but you'll be grouped over here, of course, because the men will be over here. And don't group up in one big group, but just in a smaller group of smaller groups of three or four, and see what you can come up with. Just common scenarios that you think where you feel like you're really predictably misunderstood by the other sex. Before you jump up and race to your new places, what questions can I answer here? Okay, feel free.
We've done studies in terms of sibling. I grew up with two girls, and my sense is, since there were many women and girls around the house, that I find myself in the middle or characteristics of both. But and I'm curious as to whether that has anything to do with family configuration. Or
there are a lot of studies about family communication as it affects gender role, and the results are really mixed. We don't know why.
Of course, I'm not a cinnamon. No, I don't want to make that.
No, you're right.
He was leading us up the mountain.
Oh, he was. I see. Yeah, that's a logical connection that a lot of people have explored, and people keep finding different things. So we think we haven't found the reason yet. Like, so why is it that a man in your situation comes out one way and a man in the same situation comes out a different way? There must be some other factors we don't know about yet.
Sisters.
Okay, talk to each other. This will be fun. Men over there, women over here. Remember to introduce yourself to anybody you sit down with and make yourselves look like you. Before you move your chairs, look over there. They were groups moments ago, but now look, they're arranged over here, and it's because I asked, you know, a few minutes ago, could you wind up your conversations? Now, men, we have a stronger pull to be autonomous. Don't tell me what to do. I'll finish when I'm darn well ready to finish. And I look over here, and the groups are still going, still buzzing. So, you know, maybe we've got an illustration here. I'd love if we could finish out the session this way with the men over here and the women over here. If you're too uncomfortable with it, feel free to mingle. We can have like a multi-person zone back here in the back. You might want to come around to where you can see the screen for about 5 or 6 minutes here, and then feel free to gather wherever you like. This is from some research now that Deborah Tannen has collected from several other sources about common misreadings that happen between the sexes. Again, these are characteristic mostly of Caucasian North American culture. So there are a lot of cultural variations that haven't been explored. We usually start by exploring the central tendencies of white college sophomores in America and then go from there. So a lot of the stuff begins there. One kind of misunderstanding that happens, Tannen labels troubles talk. And she says when people are talking about troubles, whether they've heard troubles from somebody else's troubles and they want to talk about them, or they're having their own kind of problem, men and women tend to do those kinds of interactions in different ways. For example, women, according to Tannen, like to show concern and match experiences, but when a woman does that with a man very often hears her stealing the floor. You know, you tell the story about having your foot run over by a trailer, and she talks about the time, remember when I was hit by a bus and broke my hip? It's like, well, thanks a lot for trumping me. Or the other thing that men sometimes hear is that your partner is demanding that you then be vulnerable, that you don't get to share stories of strength. Remember, men like to avoid sharing weaknesses about themselves. ourselves. And we sometimes hear those showing concern and matching experiences a demand that we be vulnerable. Now, man, we like to normalize the problem and talk about, oh, you know, this happens to a lot of people. Don't worry, it'll be fine. And if we have our druthers, we very often like to try and fix it for you. You're in trouble. Emily and I actually had to work something out early in our marriage where she would start on some troubles talk and I would have to stop and say, okay, now is this one I get to fix? Or do you just need to talk? Do you need me just to listen? And that actually works for us, to actually have that kind of little pre-conversation. Women often hear that kind of stuff, though, from men as very dismissive of feelings, even if they're feelings about another person's predicament. Oh, you know, she's been great before. They've worked through stuff like this before. That's not what I mean! You know, you just get these feelings that you feel for the person, you want to continue to feel for the person. I'm going to ask for your responses after I get through these four, which is why I'm kind of speeding here. Here's the second one. Let's see, in showing support, masculine and feminine styles are very different. Women like to talk for comfort and connection with partners. That's how you would show support. Men, on the other hand, see it as supportive to really not impinge on somebody else's autonomy. And that's true for us with other men and with women as well. So, for example, if you've got a guy who's feeling really bad, one of your buddies, do you quiz him? Do you ask him a lot of questions? Do you get him to talk? Or do you sit with him? Or do you leave him out in the garage by himself, you know, working on the workbench or whatever he's doing? There's this real strong pull to autonomy among men for showing support. And women don't hear that as supportive at all, generally. If you're a subscriber to a feminine style, you think, where is this guy? You know, I'm ready to talk to this guy, and he's just not here. Part of the story, I said this one last night, but it's too good not to say again, that Emily, I think you told me this one, that if women wrote the Bible, we'd know what Jesus looked like. Okay. Two waves of laughing, that's good. But that subscribers to a feminine style really like more detailed and circular storytelling. This is one Emily and I just go round and round about. I've had to lose this particular gesture. I had to lose this one. Because I love my sweetie, and I had to do it. And we prefer more sequential and straightforward storytelling. I mean, the point of talking is to get to the point of the story, and so then we can work on whatever problem is there and solve it. Whereas, you know, for the feminine style, part of the fun is just really the connection you get from enjoying the high points and the details and the various, all the frills and laces and things of a story. All right, last one. Relationship talk. This one's a biggie. When your female partner comes to you and says, we need to talk about our relationship. Men, what does that mean?
Uh-oh.
What did I do? Something's wrong. And that's really frustrating for women or for subscribers to a feminine style, because the relationship is working well for them as long as they can talk about it. That's the substance of the relationship, is communicating about it. And a spouse, I mean, I get as nervous about those words as anybody else, but when you think about it, this is a real fundamental misunderstanding. Is, you know, I want to talk to you about us, and if I unavoidably hear that as, uh-oh, I'm going to avoid it, and you're going to want more of it, and I'm going to avoid it, and you're going to want more of it, and that's it can be a real destructive cycle, a real difficult one. I struggle with the support one myself. I want to hear some examples from you in just a second, but things like, I'll stub my toe in the kitchen, and I'll go, ow, and they say, oh, are you okay? And I get mad. I'll say, I'm fine. Don't do that. You know, as a guy. And I have to I'll sit back and think about that later and think, why am I mad? I'm just trying to be kind. But really, what I'm trying to be is just self-reliant. It doesn't hurt me that much. I'm okay. I'm a man. Mm-hmm. I can handle it. Don't talk to me like I'm really hurt. It's just a total thing. So as you look at some of these, I would bet some of these intersect, not if any of these intersected with any that were in your groups. Look to see anybody else in the room who's nodding. Boy, not many nods. Okay, good. You need to hear some other stories then. Can we hear some good stories that came out of your groups? What are the situations where you feel routinely misunderstood? Let's start with the women. Let's hear one from the feminine side, please.
Said, or that one member said, was that when we're talking to our spouse or significant other and we receive no cues, body language, or anything, that they are receiving our information.
Okay, how many of you share that particular frustration? Well, so there is a difference in how we encode attention, even how it is that we show we're paying attention. I've been noticing over the last couple of years that I don't look at people very much when I talk to them, except when I'm teaching. I look at everybody, but often in conversation, a mark of intimacy for me is that we don't have to look at each other, you know. But they're in the kitchen and talk and work on, you know, cutting up the mushrooms or whatever it is you're doing, and that you don't need to look. But again, that can be misinterpreted. Something from the male side, please. Okay, back to the women. All right, one more chance. Come on.
They don't want to talk about it.
No, they do.
The topic that we came up was if we are running late and don't communicate that we're coming home late, and we can pretty much bet that we're going to be in trouble if we don't.
Okay.
If we don't call ahead.
How is your lateness interpreted?
Our lateness, or in our discussion, we said, well, with it, the wife has proceeded to start worrying
because
your being okay has not been communicated.
Okay.
So it was a lack of communication.
And what inspires us not to check in?
Autonomy.
Oh, absolutely.
We're going to get home when we want to get home.
Trust me, I'm going to make good choices. You don't have to check out with me. I hate to have somebody know that I am just beholden to my wife in terms of where I can go and what I can do. You ever hear that? Thank you, women. Or was that it? You had them all there? Go ahead.
Well, I felt that there was times when both content and tone of what was being communicated was misinterpreted. And often when we thought something was said in a neutral way, we got a defensive response.
Can you think of an example? These are great examples. Anyone over here, really, if you got an example of something that was you intended as neutral and was heard as hostile? Or even intended as supportive and was heard as hostile, like when Emily talks to me when I just stub my toe. What's that? Will you please take out the garbage? Okay, that's a relatively neutral response, though it does threaten autonomy. Stop doing what you're doing and do this instead at my request. Other examples? Something you intend to be neutral?
I was the suggestion that maybe, you know, I don't know if I really want to go to this, you know, a certain, get a meeting or a session or something. I'm not sure if I want to go that. Well, fine, we don't have to go then, you know. Like.
Right. Did you have that conversation before this particular session? Thank you. So we heard a good story here. Good story here. We're ready for another.
To tag on to the first one is, you know, if we're not watching the communication or active listening in that part, the words are not necessarily even the majority, probably much less than the majority of the message that's being sent. So then our response is usually not to what the question was or what the intent was, and therefore, man, it's back to you weren't listening, or
you weren't really listening,
or weren't really listening, or the other one a lot of times too is don't fix my problem. I want you to empathize with me, or you know, deal with me. And so it's not just that we don't. I'm not responding. I'll put it on myself, but not responding. But I'm not even getting the point of the conversation.
Okay, not even hearing the whole code. Women, I think you assume users of a feminine style often assume that everybody listens to the relational aspect of the message. We talked last night about how each message is like an icon on a computer screen. And you see the high, you just click on the high and there's a whole bunch of other stuff in there. And that users of a feminine style are much more schooled to pay attention to that stuff. That's part of being feminine, is you're really expected to be caring and sensitive. And that's what sensitive means. You're paying attention to those things. Somebody says, I'm fine. Oh, what's wrong? You know, that's the expected sort of thing. Whereas a guy might say later, well, you said you were fine. I said, you know, you want to go see Worldwide Wrestling tonight? Yeah, fine. And then later, you know, what, you aren't happy? You said you wanted to go. So that is a predictable way that we often misinterpret one another. Feminine users often assume everybody's listening to that same level of stuff. Male users think, hey, go on record. You know? I need my
verbals. The non-verbals.
Pardon?
The non-verbals, when you say, you get this look and you say, what's the matter? And it's nothing. Is that a reverse role?
I don't know. Maybe that's sort of a challenge. Like, well, can you hear my nothing? Can you click on my nothing and see everything that's there? And if you can, then maybe I'm going to put on an I'm fine after that, just so you can unpack that one too. I mean, individuals, there's a lot of variance within a style, right? I mean, everybody's different within these styles. We're looking at central tendencies. We're not looking at written rules or laws. Things that go here. I've forgotten whose turn it is. Which camp needs to speak?
I've got bad proofs. You can see one.
There you go.
Well, I think in my marriage, there's a lot of taking each other for granted. And in the way that, because we've been together so long, we expect them to feel just like we do. I remember once when we were going to do two things in the morning. We were going to go out to eat, and we were going to pick up our car before we went to another location.
Okay.
So I got in the car, and he said, "I'll." No, what did he tell me? can't even remember now, but I ended up going to where the car was. He ended up going to the restaurant.
Oh, no.
Because we had, you know, just taken for granted that we understood what we were going to do.
One of the things we know about studying the communication of people who've been together a long time, this is true of straight relationships, gay relationships, sibling relationships, friendships of all kinds, is that we use fewer and fewer words with each other. Think about when you come home at the end of the day. Emily's query of me often when I come home from school now is just, hmm? You know, that'll be the end of it. And then if you imagine doing that with a brand new friend, somebody who doesn't know you very well, you have to use more code. But there can be a point where we're different because of masculine and feminine gender role in terms of how much we assume the other person is picking up on and how much they know. Let me ask two questions here to close. One is this. Given that you understand or at least see some differences between masculine and feminine speech communities, these gender likes, these ways of speaking, can you see some concrete things that you want to do about that? Keeping in mind that tomorrow's session is focused precisely on that question. Where are you now? What are some things you might see yourself doing in response to some of these codes that would make things more just? That's okay, I can wait.
Be a better listener.
What does that mean?
To when you talk about paying attention, mm-hmm. to really pay attention and try and listen to what is being said.
Okay. And what is being meant?
What is being meant?
Paul, you were talking about this before, that you catch yourself not active listening or not watching the communication, letting it kind of go by without your eyes involved. Those kinds of things. So maybe listening better means using more of your senses in conversation. What else?
I'll just use that example of taking out the garbage. I could be more specific and say the garbage needs to be taken out, and it doesn't have to be done immediately, but it needs to be taken out today.
Ooh, very nice. Respecting autonomy a little more, giving some choice in the matter. Okay, go ahead.
I'm saying what I mean.
As opposed to
saying fine.
I see. Giving us a little help. Other things you might do. Right.
Ending the sentence less definitive, so it doesn't mm-hmm. sound so critical and close. You know, and putting on a you think or a, you know, softening the tail end of the statement so it doesn't sound like I'm being, you know, authoritative on that.
Or I'm not trying for the last word necessarily. That's a good idea. that's a tough one for, you know, we're socialized to really, if we do conversation for status and dominance and things, that's a hard thing to get over. Well, I think we'll be fine. Don't you? So this is a nice segue to the second question. And remember that every session in Holden is designed to raise more questions than it answers. So there are lots of places to have conversation. In fact, there's really nothing to do at Holden. So really all you do is converse. There's absolutely no events going on. And, you know, it's just total absolute dead time. So really just spend your time talking to other people. I'm kidding, of course. So these kinds of things. Here's my second question. Thinking about changing a style that you've been raised with, think about what sorts of benefits might come to you by enlarging your repertoire to include some things if you're masculine from a more feminine style, and think the same if you're feminine, including more of a masculine style of communication. And don't just think in terms of benefits, but what costs do you see of doing that? Go ahead, Karen. You start us. That was a big nod.
Well, I tend to be a real collaborative kind of talker, and I want audience feedback is to flip a description. I want connection, and that's a trait that's gotten me into trouble. I told my small group about a job situation where I was perceived as powerless, without authority, and weak, indecisive. I could add more. You get the idea. And there's more words than that, but you get the general gist. And the cost per, didn't want to function differently than I did, because I thought for me that was an authentic way to work. And I wasn't willing to take on a masculine style of that I was being encouraged to take on that was very much more arbitrary, win the point. Certainly don't seek feedback from other people. Be real careful about even taking feedback from other people. Be solitary, be decisive, do what you think is right, and make other people think you're smart, even if you're not very nice.
Okay. And you were uncomfortable adopting the whole
thing. I was not. Because the situation I was in, I valued the relationships. And I felt like a huge risk.
So here's a good insight then, is that these behaviors are not value free. They aren't just these abstract ways of acting, but when you start acting a different way, you're roping in a different set of cultural values and cultural practices. If you
this
become a man who becomes
faith.
More tentative and softer at the end of sentences, that makes you're avowing a different identity than the one you do when you're really, you know, slamming the door at the end of each of your sentences. And that doesn't come without some baggage. What else? What other costs or benefits do you see? Oh, Bill Clinton got some of that same criticism, Karen. You're in the same category. He wasn't decisive enough. He asked too many people.
I'm not sure.
Especially early in his tenure. It was intended to be just a comparison.
Okay.
Being a sensitive person,
yes.
And in the feminine type of thing.
Yes.
Being over, maybe sometimes oversensitive for myself and for others. So adapting a shortcut version instead of a verbatim, you know, in responses can be of benefit, but people really don't expect to hear just a one-word response, you know.
From a woman?
Yeah, I don't.
They ascribe a different identity to a woman on the outside.
Has bad words attached to it, yeah. If you come across, for a woman, come across as extremely authoritative and not take back talk. There are bad words that go to get attached to that.
Oh, indeed there are.
You would be, women are often labeled to be aggressive when they're assertive.
That's right.
Especially in the workplace. Men, what's comparable for us? What if we were to adopt some pieces of the feminine style? What's that cost? Women adopt a masculine style and they get labeled with the B word. What do we get?
You're weak.
Sissy.
All the things you heard in junior high.
Yeah.
And hopefully you haven't heard them since then, before they stay there, don't they?
Yeah.
Remember those kinds of words? What does that cost you, though? You get called those things. So what?
Pride.
Okay. It has something to do with how you think of yourself and whether you were proud of yourself. What else?
Being taken advantage of.
Okay. Worry about being taken advantage of?
Being strong.
Okay. Being seen as strong or being strong?
Being seen as being strong.
Okay, so you're just as strong as you were, but you may not be seen as strong. Okay. And you can put yourself in a situation where then you may have to fight for things that before were just given to you because of how you communicated. Other people might presume that you're a couple rungs down, and so even though you're still where you were, in your own mind, other people are going to put you here, and maybe then you have to really do some extra things to make sure they don't take advantage of you as not necessarily as masculine as you could be. So this is kind of a dilemma. When we're thinking about this, I don't mean to leave you really down in the mouth here, like looking around the room and you're kind of going, oh, dang. But tonight really was just about the troubles. That's what I was hoping to do, was to say, you know, men and women communicate in really distinct ways, and we're socialized to do that. Holden Village is really unique in that it attracts a populace generally that is not as hidebound by those descriptions as many other populations are. Tomorrow I really would like to apply some of the principles of competent intercultural communication to this very scenario, and we'll see what we come up with that might be of use, that doesn't necessarily involve the kinds of costs that you're talking with about tonight, but may in fact bring up some of the benefits you've mentioned and perhaps more. So thanks for your attention. I hope to see many of you tomorrow for the punchline.